Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right, from the New York Times, in case you needed the New York Times to tell you, so long to tech's dream job. It's the shut up and grind era, tech workers say, as Apple, Google, and other giants age into large bureaucracies.
Mm-hmm.
We start off with Rachel Gray, who started working at Google as a software engineer in 2007. And it was a good time to be a Noogler, or what the search giant called new employees. Kitchens were stocked with fresh juices, and gyms offered free workout classes. But what also made an impression on Ms. Gray during orientation was that Google revealed how many machines were in its data centers. Quote, I saw how transparent things were in the company, she said, about the normally hush-hush information. But over the years, though, her experience changed as she became a software engineering manager. Employees were no longer provided a fire hose of corporate information. The company abandoned a pledge that its artificial intelligence would not be used for weapons. The budget for promotions dried up, pressuring Ms. Gray to lower performance ratings, which she said was, quote, stunningly painful. But the turning point came in 2022 and 2023, when Elon Musk bought Twitter, renamed X, and shed 3/4 of its employees. Google and Amazon also conducted mass layoffs. Many of the companies blamed the pandemic for their overhiring during lockdowns as more people turned to digital services. But along the way, the companies became less tolerant of employee outspokenness. Bosses reasserted themselves after workers protested issues including sexual harassment in the workplace. And with the job market flooded with quality engineers, it became easier to replace those who criticized. Now, some would say the changes have simply aligned tech workers with the rest of corporate America, where employees are accustomed to fulfilling corporate priorities.
Mm-hmm.
According to Catherine Bracey, the founder and chief executive of Tech Equity, a nonprofit that pushes for economic inclusion in the industry, quote, the tide has definitely turned against tech workers, and AI is supercharging that. Some workers are also leaving big tech to join the AI fray. There's one Jason Yuan, 28. He started as a designer at Apple's headquarters in Cupertino in 2021. Felt like a lucky break to work for a company that he revered for its design, he said. But after the AI boom, Mr. Yuan yearned to get involved. So he left Apple to start New Computer, a company that makes a personal companion chatbot. He hopes to work more speedily and make more money as AI is likely to replace him in his lifetime, he said. Quote, there's a feeling of, I have to make whatever I do now count. But for Ms. Gray, Google's exhilarating early days seem like just another lifetime ago. The work was never easy, but company culture made it easier to power through. She recalled one day when she and her coworkers arrived to find Nerf guns on their desk, and when a power outage hit, they grabbed their Nerf guns and broke into a friendly fight.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I've worked for companies like that, and they're all bankrupt now. Like, there is a certain amount of, it's a job, and if you've convinced yourself that this job is going to be the perfect part that makes your life happy, you're the one who's delusional.
Well, there's also something to be said for rejecting the way work looks now, which, if you've read Accounting for Slavery by Caitlin Rosenthal, love plugging that book, you'll notice how much of modern management and corporate culture was optimized thanks to slavery.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely room to swing the pendulum back a little bit and not treat people like machines, for sure. But also, like, I think anybody who walked into Google in the early days and was like, this is super sustainable from a corporate perspective is like, you don't understand business.
Yeah. There's something to be said for instituting something like recess, but we don't have to buy Nerf guns for everyone, right? There's a way for us to, like, look at the bottom line, but still introduce a little bit of, I don't know, humanity, playfulness, and not in the Worldwide Wrestling Federation form we have right now, but like true play, right?
I don't know. I feel like a wrestling championship in the office might actually make it better.
I mean, that's what we're setting up right now. So careful what you wish for. All right. Next link.
Next link.
We'll keep it in the realm of technological hellscapes for this one. This article comes to us from ArsTechnica.com titled, After using ChatGPT, man swaps his salt for sodium bromide and suffers psychosis.
Yep.
Yeah, so after seeking advice on health topics from ChatGPT, a 60-year-old man who had a history of studying nutrition in college decided to try a health experiment. He would eliminate all chlorine from his diet, which for him meant eliminating even table salt, which is sodium chloride. His ChatGPT conversations led him to believe that he could replace his sodium chloride with sodium bromide, which he obtained over the internet.
Did they say where he studied?
No.
Or did he even complete his studies? Because they said he studied it, but he didn't necessarily get a degree.
That's true. I study business for half a semester.
Yeah. And that portion, history of studying nutrition in college, is in scare quotes, just so you know. Okay. Yeah. So 3 months later, the man showed up at his local emergency room. His neighbor, he said, was trying to poison him. And though he was extremely thirsty, the man was paranoid about accepting the water that the hospital offered him, telling doctors that he had begun distilling his own water at home and that he was on an extremely restrictive vegetarian diet. He did not mention the sodium bromide or the ChatGPT discussions.
Way to bury the lead, buddy.
Yeah. His distress, coupled with the odd behavior, led the doctors to run a broad set of lab tests, revealing multiple micronutrient deficiencies, especially in key vitamins. But the bigger problem was that the man appeared to be suffering from a serious case of bromism, which is an excess amount of the element bromine in the body.
Oh, it's not too much, Joe Rogan.
A century ago, somewhere around 8 to 10% of all psychiatric admissions in the U.S. were caused by bromism. Cool. That's because, then as now, people wanted sedatives to calm their anxieties, to blot out a cruel world, or simply to get a good night's sleep. Things like potassium bromide were once drugs of choice for this sort of thing. But unfortunately, bromide can easily build up in the human body, where too much of it impairs nerve function. This causes a wide variety of problems, including grotesque skin rashes and significant mental problems, which are all grouped under the name of bromism. Bromide sedatives vanished from the U.S. market by 1989 after the Food and Drug Administration banned them, and bromism as a syndrome is today unfamiliar to many Americans. You can still get it by doing things like drinking, as one poor guy did, 2 to 4 liters of cola daily, if that cola contains brominated vegetable oil.
Ooh.
Fortunately, the FDA removed brominated vegetable oil from U.S. food products in 2024, which is very recent. So, in this case, over the man's first day at the hospital, he grew worse and showed increasing paranoia and auditory and visual hallucinations. He then attempted to escape the facility. After the escape attempt, the man was given an involuntary psychiatric hold and an anti-psychosis drug. He was administered large amounts of fluids and electrolytes, as the best way to beat bromism is to load someone up with liquids and let them pee all of the bromide out of their system.
Oh.
Yeah.
This took time, as the man's bromide level was eventually measured at a whopping 1,700 milligrams per liter, while the reference range for healthy people is 0.9 to 7.3 milligrams per liter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we're talking like 1,000 to, 500 times more, basically.
But the important question, did he have any chlorine in his body?
That is a good question. It does not say.
I guess it didn't really matter since he intentionally poisoned himself with something else.
So, in the end, the man suffered from this terrifying psychosis and was kept in the hospital for 3 full weeks. And once doctors had his psychosis under control, the man began telling them how it all began. He had read about the problems with too much table salt, which led him to ChatGPT, which led him to believe that he could use sodium bromide instead.
Even though it was still sodium. Like, he didn't even understand the problem.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, it's still a salt, technically. Yeah.
It was the chlorine he was looking to get rid of. That pool material, right? Nobody wants that in their body.
So the doctors who wrote up this case study for Annals of Internal Medicine note that they never got access to the man's actual ChatGPT logs. Bromide salts can be substituted for table salt, just not in the human body.
For all those other things you use table salt for, like ghosts and throwing it over your shoulder. Those are the ways you can use it.
Yeah. No, they're used in various cleaning products and pool treatments. So that's what they're referring to. But
okay.
Yeah. So the doctors did try their own searches in ChatGPT 3.5, which, by the way, is truly terrible, especially at fact checking and safety.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that the AI did include bromide in its response, but it also indicated that context mattered and that bromide was not suitable for all uses. But the AI did not provide a specific health warning, nor did it inquire about why we wanted to know, as we presume a medical professional would do, wrote the doctors. The current free model of ChatGPT does appear to be better at answering this sort of query. When the author of this article asked ChatGPT how to replace chloride in his diet, it first asked to clarify your goal, giving three choices, which is to reduce salt in diet or home use, avoid toxic or reactive chlorine compounds like pool chlorine, or replace chlorine-based disinfecting agents. It listed bromide as an alternative, but only under the third option related to cleaning, noting that bromide treatments are often used in hot tubs.
Yep.
This story seems like a perfect cautionary tale for the modern age where we are drowning in info but often lack the economic resources and domain-specific knowledge and trust in others that could help us make the best use of it.
Well, all right. I mean, this guy saved himself from the Darwin outcome he just probably barely should have had, but
yeah. And, you know, I don't know if y'all seen the reactions to the new GPT-5 coming out and how they pulled 4.0? Like,
yeah,
that's
it's kind of sad.
Yeah,
it's very frightening.
There was a thing that I read where I guess there's a subreddit called Boyfriend is My AI or AI is My Boyfriend.
Yeah.
And people were distraught because of how attached they had gotten to 4.0 that ChatGPT rolled it back out.
Yeah.
We're all desperate for connection, and they've handed it to us in a spoon.
Well, they've given us a really good facsimile of connection.
Right, but it's enough for our desperate brains to go, oh, human connection versus computer connection. That's like sodium chloride versus sodium bromide. It's fine. We can just swap them out.
That's right. That's right. The drink a lot of water and pee it out is going to be quite the reckoning.
Can you pee out ChatGPT? That would be great.
We should ask ChatGPT.
Next link.
Next link.
I mean, I'll stay on the not great news part, but this is from The Guardian. Was everything brighter 40 years ago? How color perception changes as we age. So, depending on how your eyes and brain age, the bright red balloon you remember from your 7th birthday might not look as vivid if you come across it again at 93.
Mm-hmm.
This can happen for a couple of reasons. One common factor is just structural shifts in the eye. For instance, a cataract can gradually tint vision with a yellow-brown brunescent hue.
Hmm.
A brunescent lens can pull the blue and green out of the world. So after a cataract was removed, one of the doctors mentioned in the article wears a bright blue tie to either delight or shock his recovering patients.
Nice.
So this can also be caused by glaucoma or macular degeneration. And research from 2024 found that up to 15% of global dementia cases could be linked to problems with color perception issues.
Huh.
Some medications can also affect color perception, namely Viagra.
Oh.
Apparently, pilots are required to abstain from it because of its blue perception that it will kill.
Huh. It's a little blue pill, and it
I know, and it just gets grayer and grayer every
That's
time
funny.
You take it. Yeah. And how are they know? I mean, are you sure pilots are not taking Viagra? I mean, of all people. And there are also some types of heart and tuberculosis medications that can do the same. But despite medication or eye diseases, color perception can shift over the course of our lives. Dr. Van Leeuwen, I'm definitely pronouncing her name wrong, a social scientist and honorary research fellow at the University College London's Queen Square Institute of Neurology, noticed older adults consistently rated colors duller than younger participants did. And she set out to investigate why. Do we actually see it? Is it the brain or is it the eye that's changing it? And her 2023 study involves 17 young adults, 20 older adults, and an eye-tracking experiment featuring 26 colors. These varied in lightness and saturation. And in using a camera that recorded pupil diameter 1,000 times per second, her team observed how participants' pupils reacted to each color. They found a reduction in the way older people's pupils responded to more highly saturated colors, even when correcting for, I guess there's a shrunken baseline in pupil sizes as we get older. She actually recalls one participant saying, "Oh, it's a shame there's not a real punchy red." And she was thinking, you're looking at one. The issue, she explains, doesn't necessarily originate in the eyes, but in the brain. Pupil responses are controlled by the Edinger-Westphal nucleus. This is a midbrain structure that receives input from the retina and the visual cortex. This means pupillary reactions reflect both what the eyes detect and how the brain processes this information. Your brain is just getting dull.
Well, it's tired of it. It's like, I've seen that it's red. Seen it. I'm not excited anymore.
So this leads us to, you're older. Is there anything you can do to stop this? No.
Okay. Good to know.
Yeah. No, but there is some evidence that the brain can be, quote, trained to see the world differently. Anya Hulbert, a color and vision scientist at the Newcastle University, points to a 2020 study involving N-chroma glasses, which feature a saturation boosting tint to help reduce the effects of some color blindness. I'm sure you all have seen those videos of the people putting them on. But this is interesting to note. The participants with the red-green color perception deficiencies who wore the glasses reported seeing increased color saturation even after removing them, right? It's like the brain was like, hey, that exists, actually. It's okay for your brain to see that. And it starts actually picking that up, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Alternatively, just surround yourself with lots of crazy colors.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like we're basically a step away from there's colors that young people see that old people can't. And it becomes like that hearing test where you can play the noise and all the kids in the room perk up and all the adults are like, what? I don't see it. So now kids are going to be passing messages to each other and you're just like, that's just a red square of paper. And the kids are like, it says Mr. Jones is a dumbass. Like,
well, it's a good thing probably a whole lot of kids don't listen to this podcast. Right. Or maybe they do. I don't know.
If we put it in high frequencies.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. Next up, we've got a profile from the BBC about an IT worker who recently defected from North Korea and is now sharing his story about what it's like to be an IT worker in North Korea.
Oh.
Ooh.
And you might be thinking to yourself, oh, hey, maybe North Korean society is doing a little better than we thought if they've got a need for IT workers. But no, they don't. Because according to Jin Soo, whose name has been changed to protect his identity, what his department actually did was pose under fake identities to secure remote IT positions in other countries.
What?
And while he admits that in some cases they would use their positions to steal data or else just hack the system and demand a ransom, most of the time they did it just to collect a paycheck in strong foreign currencies, 85% of which went directly back to the North Korean regime. Of course, it should be noted that nothing Jin Soo says about the North Korean government can be independently confirmed, but apparently his account does line up with other interviews given by other North Korean defectors. And we do know of at least a few instances where ransomware attacks were ultimately traced back to North Koreans using fake identities. This includes a case last year in which a St. Louis court indicted 14 North Koreans who allegedly extorted a total of $88 million from U.S. firms over a six-year period, as well as another case from just last week when an American woman was sentenced to more than 8 years in prison for stealing identities specifically to sell to North Koreans looking for American IT jobs. And that case was unusual precisely because it's rare to find someone in America, even among criminals, who is interested in helping out North Korea. Jin Soo says that normally what they actually have to do is first pose as a Chinese person and reach out to individuals in, for example, Hungary or Turkey, and give them a sob story about like, hey, I'm just trying to make a living, but it's really hard to get hired as a Chinese person because, of course, everyone thinks I'm a spy. So if you let me use your identity to get honest work, then I'll give you a cut of my paycheck. So in these cases, they're not even stealing the identities. They're just preying on people's empathy and saying, let me use your name. So then once they've secured a Hungarian identity to use, they reach out to people in Western Europe, saying, you know, it's really hard to get hired as a Hungarian because people in Western countries just don't trust foreigners. So if you let me use your identity, I'll give you a cut of my paycheck. And only after they've secured a Western European identity can they hope to successfully apply for American IT jobs. But even though it takes a whole chain of fake identities to get there, the fact is it is working. Jinsu says that it was a given for him and his colleagues to work multiple jobs at a time, and that he generally grossed around $5,000 a month before the government took their cut, but that others in his department were successfully juggling more.
Ugh. Well, it's a good thing that the IT companies now are grinding. They may be hiring less of those people now, maybe.
996!
Yeah, well, and, you know, demanding that people be in office, it sucks for genuine remote American workers, but also it's like, we guaranteed you're a dude sitting at a desk at least.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, of course, the main reason this scheme works is because even if you don't speak English well, which most of them don't, the vast majority of the job is done over email and messaging. So as long as you can put up your one English speaker for the initial video interview and you have some translation software, you're solid. And like we said, some companies have gotten wise to the practice and perhaps even straight up racist against Asian-looking job candidates. But the latest crop of video AI tools have made it so that the one North Korean in their department who speaks English can make his face look like anything he wants. In fact, according to Rob Henley, the co-founder of Ally Security in the U.S., the most effective way he's found to verify a remote job candidate's nationality is to make them carry their camera over to the window and point it at the sun to prove what time zone they're in. In response, however, North Korea has been using its diplomatic ties with China and Russia to physically relocate some of their remote IT workers into those countries, though they do remain under extreme supervision as well as the threat of harm to their relatives if they ever try to escape. Which, of course, Jinsu did, and they just sort of leave that implication hanging, which is pretty horrible. Yep. But he, at least, is settling into a successful life post-defection. He's still working in IT, and while his paycheck is lower since he's only working one job, he does get to keep all of it now, which works out to a lot more in his pocket. So, you know, as much as we all love remote work, the lesson here kind of is don't outsource your IT, or you're going to get your company held for ransom.
That's cute. We're all going to be outsourcing it to AI in like a month, right?
Right. And that's probably part of it, too. They're like, well, if they're all AI, then it doesn't matter. But it could be a Korean AI. Like, I just, you know, I don't know. I feel like there was some charm to the really disgruntled in-person IT guy who everybody disliked and was always really grumpy about his job and come and be like, move and just sit in your computer and fix it. But also, he was there. And there's something delightful about that. Next link.
Next link.
All right, for something completely different, we are going to Smithsonian Magazine because a gigantic walking stick discovered in Australia might be the continent's heaviest insect.
That says a lot because Australia has some insane insects.
True. It does. And it is a really big walking stick insect. There's a picture. It's not that scary, but I'm a little biased. I played Animal Crossing, got a little of my insect desensitization out with that. But at 15.75 inches long, the new species called Acrophylla alta and described in the journal Zootaxa looks like a pretty massive twig. Now, the longest known stick insects can grow to over 20 inches, but those are lighter than the recently discovered species. This supersized A. alta weighs about 44 grams, which is a little bit less than a golf ball. So because it dwells in the high altitude rainforest way up in the canopy, it explains why it had not been discovered really until now. It's a cool, wet environment where they live. Their body mass likely helps them survive these colder conditions, and that's why they've developed into this rather large insect over millions of years. Now, they found two more female specimens since, but researchers have yet to identify a male of the species. That's because the male insects are smaller than their female counterparts, and they also look really different. According to researchers, quote, you really need to find the male actually copulating with the female because then you know what it is and you can collect the eggs and truly ascertain that they're one of the same thing.
I'm picturing them like the giant praying mantis thing in Disco Elysium that's like communicating through the brain and it's like twice as tall as a person. Like maybe the males are smaller, but maybe they're bigger. Do you ever think of that?
It is a new species. You know, everything we know could be turned upside down.
Exactly.
But this discovery does highlight the importance of looking towards higher ground and higher branches as we look for new species. The canopies are actually not very well studied in our forest environments. So there's a chance there are many more species in the canopies than we can even imagine. The scary thing is we may be losing species before we even know they exist.
I guess they're climbing these trees up into the canopies with ropes. Because I'm initially picturing them with ladders, and I'm just like, you're not going to hike into the rainforest with that. But if it's living
ropes,
only,
yeah.
I mean, the canopy of a rainforest is high. That's, yeah. you know, 30, yeah. 40 feet off the ground at least. Yeah. So they're getting
well,
up there.
Well, you can have those, like, roll-out rope ladders, which aren't rigid. Like, you just roll them up. That
okay.
could work.
Or maybe they're just shaking the tree really hard.
Right, right, right. Or like a Batman grappling gun, like you shoot the hook up and then it just lifts you right up into the canopy.
I mean, we could be looking into developing magic beans for beanstalks that we could just,
sure.
you know?
Open to all possibilities.
That's right. That's right. Next link?
Next link.
This article also comes to us from Smithsonian Mag, titled, "This snail can regrow its eyes, and understanding how may one day help humans with injuries."
Eye injuries or all injuries?
Eye injuries, I believe. Yeah.
I hope so.
So at first glance, snails and humans don't seem. Yeah. They don't seem to share many similarities, but our eyes are actually structurally akin to those of freshwater golden apple snails, a species native to South America. These snails have a spectacular ability. After an eye is amputated, they can regrow a new functional one within about a month. Now, scientists have uncovered a gene related to eye development in the snails. Alice Accorsi, a biologist and lead author of the study, became interested in golden apple snails as a graduate student in Italy, where the species is invasive and abundant. Mm. She tells Tina Hesman-Say at Science News, "You could literally buy them in a pet store as snails that clean the bottom of the fish tanks." Interestingly, the same traits that make them invasive pests also make them excellent laboratory animals. They are resilient, grow quickly, reproduce abundantly. They also have direct development without larval phase or metamorphosis, which simplifies their life cycle for experimental work. Accorsi and her colleagues used dissections, microscopy, and genetic analysis to study the snail's eyes and their similarity to human eyes. The gastropods, like us, have camera-type eyes with a cornea, a lens, and a retina with cells to capture light. The team found that the apple snails and humans share several genes related to eye development. They also determined the different stages of the snail's eye regeneration process. In the first 24 hours after an eye is amputated, the wound begins to heal. The body sends unspecialized cells to the affected area, then in just over a week, those cells specialize by beginning to form eye structures. Within 2 weeks of the amputation, the eye structures are all present, though they still need a few weeks to mature. The researchers also found that the same gene, called PAX6, is used to form eyes in both the snails and humans. Study co-author Alejandro Sanchez Alvarado explains, "With the advent of CRISPR technology, we can now manipulate genes in this species. This included targeted disruption of the PAX6 gene, an essential regulator in eye development and regeneration. Without functional PAX6 genes, the lab snails developed without eyes," which, you know, a little messed up to do that to some snails, but, you know, "humans won't be regrowing eyes just yet. The team is currently working to better understand the different genes involved in eye regeneration. To investigate this further, the researchers will need to mutate or turn off PAX6 in adult snails, then assess their ability to regenerate their eyes. If they find a set of snail genes that are important to eye regeneration and vertebrates also have those genes, scientists might be able to one day activate them in humans."
I mean, it could be like you trigger that gene and you get your eye back, but you also grow a snail shell. Like, we don't know what all it
It makes
for.
You like you can no longer tolerate salt. So it's all bromide from here on out.
So I will get on my a very tiny soapbox and say you should absolutely read this book called The Body Electric, because it goes all into these studies of planarian flatworms and salamanders who can regenerate. And the authors are trying to figure out, like, why can't humans? And the answer is that we probably can with some electrical stimulation, but also the icky part is that if the wound cauterizes, it can't regenerate. So you would basically need to have, like, this globula of, like, raw flesh that's healing, along with some sort of electrical current in order to persistently stimulate that regeneration.
And keep infection out at the same time.
Yes.
Like, that seems, yeah.
But it has to stay, like, kind of wet and fluid.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Oh,
yeah.
Boy.
Which is, like, real yucky. Yeah.
Yeah, but if you put that in some kind of cast system, you know,
true.
I'm sure it'll be fun.
Like, the wildest thing I learned from that book is that they are essentially asserting that the information of, like, why your, you know, your left side is your left side and the right side side is the right side and all that is because of the flow of electricity in your body system. And they came to this conclusion because if you cut a planarian flatworm in half, it'll regenerate. But if you run an electrical current through it so that the polarity reverses, it will regenerate ahead where the tail was and vice versa.
Wow.
It gets real weird in that book real fast.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very scientific.
I'm interested. Yeah, because I can't wear a watch without killing it. Something is going on with my magnetic.
Grow a new hand.
Oh, yeah. I had a friend like that in college who she would break computers just by using them. Like her computer teacher was like, get out.
Don't come near me.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what it is, but yeah, I've never.
You're ready to regrow something. Let's find out.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's time to cut your wrist off is what I'm hearing.
Okay. Yeah, I'll try it. Just so if we can put it on YouTube and I can monetize it. Let's do it.
Listen, it's the modern gig economy. You got to take what you can get.
Will Mr. Beast give me some money for it? I'll do it.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include The Great Sword Heist of 2025, Is It True That Sharks Don't Get Cancer, and NASA Rovers Keep Getting Stuck, and We Finally Know Why. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInterestingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.